Hello and welcome to Dialects from the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol and also to my listeners on Preston FM on 103.2 and also on Radio Verulam in St Albans and also some listeners in Swindon. Hello to you all in Swindon. My name is John Peters Coleman.
And I'm Sophia Costa. Coming up in the show...
He stands there, apparently robed in white, on the banks of the Jordan, baptising the next generation of Murdochs while calling for new war against Iran and Syria. This is a war addict as peace envoy, and frankly, Tony Blair shouldn't be paddling around in the Holy River. He ought to be taken to where he can account for his aggressive actions over the last 10 years instead.
Yes, later on in the show, you can hear Andrew Murray from Unite the Union. His speech on the war was made at the Trade Union Annual Congress in London last month.
In the show this week, we also have a Mexican theme going on. I interview Marisol Asuncion from Mexico, and she's studying Teotihuacan Civilization at Bristol University, and she's here in the studio to share some of her research with us. We also have an interview on a bus in Yucatan in Mexico. A young man describes what it is like to live in a violent country.
Mark Sayers reads his poetry. Jess Sparks is back with the What's On Guide. Now for some Mexican music before we welcome our first guest. Okay, I'd like to welcome Marisol Asuncion to the studio. Hello.
Hello.
So you've just started studying at Bristol University, is that right?
I've been here 1 year already.
Okay. And you are, what are you studying?
I'm doing a PhD in chemistry.
And that also involves the Teotihuacan civilization, is that right?
Yeah, my project is about studying archaeological material and make them chemical analysis to study the paleo diet or the diet that this Mesoamerican culture had in the past, like 2,000 years ago.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about where you're from, because you're from Mexico yourself, which is why I assume you wanted to do the study of this civilization, is that right?
Yeah, I'm from Mexico City, and I contacted my supervisor, but I didn't ask for a topic from Mexico. I just wanted to be part of the research group. And when I mentioned that I was Mexican, he said that he had always wanted to push this project forward, well, this Teotihuacan project. So I was the best person to do it because I'm from the country and I know the culture. And
okay.
Yeah.
So where did you do your degree itself? Was that here or was that back in Mexico?
No. My degree was in Mexico.
Okay. What brought you to Britain?
I've always wanted to do a PhD abroad, so because of the language and my supervisor, and that is what brought me to Britain.
Okay, was that the first time that you'd ever come here to Britain?
Yeah.
What was your first impressions of arriving in Bristol then, having lived in Mexico City?
It was raining. My first day in Bristol was raining, so it wasn't very nice. But this year has been very interesting, so it's been good that I've been here.
So what had you studied regarding various main civilizations up until this point, or was studying a civilization in depth in itself quite a new thing?
Quite a new thing. I don't think it's quite a new thing.
I mean, do they teach you a lot about main civilizations when you're in school
in
general?
Yes, of course, that is a big part of our education. Like,
yeah.
Because in Mexico, it was not just Teotihuacan or the Mayas or the Aztecs that kept their cities there or developed there. There were loads and loads, like it was a whole region that with loads of cultures that shared subsistence patterns. It was like a Europe, but in the Mexican territory, like in a small territory or a big one or a medium size, whatever. Like it was different countries, and in this case, they are called civilizations. So it was quite interesting.
Okay. So what sort of discoveries have you made in your research about their diet?
Well, not yet, because I have struggled with bureaucracy to import my samples. But I've been working on reference material. This technique that I am using is where you study or analyze ceramic vessels and extract some organic residues that are encapsulated in the matrix of the pots, and they are analyzed through chromatography and mass spectrometry. But to that, you have to compare it with reference materials or products likely to have been exploited in the past with other information like external remains or from other cultures as well. So information, you've got to have a background before starting analyzing your materials.
Yeah.
So that's what I've been doing this first year, working on reference materials and try to identify several compounds likely to be preserved in the pottery. And then when my samples come next month, I will try to match the structures that I've been studying or trying to or suggesting.
Yeah.
And match them if I find them in the archaeological material, or look for another one, so to track the food sources that.
Okay, what do we know about what they would have eaten?
Well, all Mesoamerican cultures in general ate loads of maize and beans, so that is, well, certainly we know that that was the basis of their diet. But in particular, my project is looking for animal protein sources, because there are not so many evidence of a lot of consumption of animal protein. So if you only eat maize and beans,
yeah,
it is very likely that the person have nutritional stress because you're not receiving all the nutrients.
So you're trying to work out what sort of animals that have eaten to accompany that diet.
Because the cities are so complex and with these very big structures, like this huge pyramid. So it was like very demanding society, I don't know, type of work.
Yeah.
So what we think is that they couldn't have just eaten maize and beans because they wouldn't have survived the stress or physical work that it...
How does the dietary information about this particular civilization, the Teotihuacans, differ from what we might know about other similar civilizations? Like, for example, in the West, you've probably heard of also the Aztecs or the Mayans. Like, do they tend to know more about those?
Yeah, we tend to know more, especially from the Mayas and the Aztecs, because these civilizations continued until the Spanish came. So when the Spanish came, they wrote everything, no? And they put them in record. So, yes, one of the main things is that if we learn from Teotihuacan, we will learn from all the cultures.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Will you be going to on-site places? Would that help you at all? Or are you sort of relatively removed from... Are you just sort of staying here in Bristol to do your studies?
Well, I have to go to Mexico for samples. It's between Mexico and Bristol, because here's where the lab and all the instruments are.
Okay, so you get a little taste of home at least anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah. How long is your PhD going on for? Is it 2 years?
No, 4 years.
4 years. So what are you planning for the rest of your PhD?
Well, do the archaeological analysis and then go into conferences and lectures and...
Okay.
And write a thesis eventually. Yeah.
So tell me a little bit about the Teotihuacans, or what you know about them, because I mean, many people will not have heard of them.
Yeah, they are among the Mesoamerican cultures. It is one of the most important because it was the only city that represents an entire culture, whereas the other Mesoamerican cultures were like conquerors, and they always try to spread, and like the Aztecs, they conquered the whole the center of Mexico. And Teotihuacan, they traded with other cultures instead of conquering. So they were quite friendly. And they didn't write anything. They have no writing system, so that is also very different in comparison to, for example, Mayas, that they wrote everything and they had a numerical system and this calendar. And
was that quite unusual, like for a trade, a heavy?
Yeah, that is very, very unusual.
Hmm.
Yeah, that is what makes it special.
So, because they're very peaceful, they're sort of like the Switzerland of the Mesoamerican culture.
Yeah, something like that. They had the city is 20 square kilometers, and there are some wares that are known to be the foreign, where people from the south of the country lived, and they had their houses and their workshops and everything. And then on the other part of the city, there was the local people.
Okay. Yeah. Does that mean quite a lot of their civilization survived because they were not? I mean, were they eventually, did they come into contact with the Spanish and become?
No, Teotihuacan fall 700 years before the Spanish came. Nobody knows. That's why it's also intriguing why they just burned the city without telling, because they didn't leave any written record. People just don't know why. Being such an amazing city, or their own population destroyed it.
Okay, and that remains a mystery.
Yeah, it remains a mystery.
Okay. Well, what do you think, I mean, how do you feel about your sort of studies in Britain? Do you want to sort of spread your wings and maybe travel a little bit more around Europe? And
oh, yes, of course. That is one of the reasons why I wanted to do a PhD abroad, because I had the opportunity to travel.
Okay, brilliant. Well, and then enjoy your travel, and hopefully you enjoy Bristol, and you'll be able to come back and tell us about your impressions of it. Marisol Skunsian, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
The silly season is over now. We've had the Lib Dem, the Labour, and now the Conservative Party conference too. None of them particularly inspiring, and nor, some would say, democratic. But what about the UK Independence Party and the Green Party conference? Why so little coverage of them? And there is one more, the Trades Union Congress, or TUC, and their conference a week before the Lib Dems, and many would argue that. Far from being troublemaking Reds, the trade unions are one of the only institutions in the country which still value free speech, and, more importantly, democracy. Here is Andrew Murray from the Unite, the union, speaking on the subject of war at the TUC Annual Congress.
Andrew Murray, Unite, moving motion 71. President, on Monday morning you asked delegates to renew this movement's commitment to world peace. What this motion does is address that very issue which has been most scarred by endless war over the last decade and beyond, wars in which our governments, British governments, have been deeply responsible. This addresses several issues of tremendous importance, this motion. The one on which I can, I think, be briefest is the question of Palestine. Not because it is not of central importance. We all know, the experience of the last 60 years teaches us, there will be no peace in the Middle East without justice for the Palestinian people. However, this issue was thoroughly debated last year at Congress, and basically our motion with the amendments, the welcome amendments from PCS, which we're accepting, seek to strengthen that basic position. Of course, our main new demand now this year must be that the British government give all out 100% support to the demand for recognition of a Palestinian state when it is discussed at the United Nations General Assembly later on. But of course, there is at least one other thing that's essential for peace in the Middle East, and that is a new Middle East peace envoy, because the present one is almost beyond parody. He stands there, apparently robed in white, on the banks of the Jordan, baptising the next generation of Murdochs, while calling for new war against Iran and Syria. This is a war addict as peace envoy, and frankly, Tony Blair shouldn't be paddling around in the Holy River. He ought to be taken to where he can account for his aggressive actions over the last 10 years instead. Now, Libya. Of course, there may be some colleagues here who will think that the situation in Libya has changed and has changed for the better, but we need to be very careful on this issue. For one thing, David Cameron is now saying interventionism is back. That is the last thing the Middle East or the world needs. And let's remember that David Cameron sought support for this war in Libya on the basis of one issue only, the protection of civilians. Well, if it was about protecting civilians, quite apart from the absurdity of bombing them in order to protect attacked them, why did the British government brush aside one ceasefire proposal after another, and even now continues to brush aside all peace proposals from the African Union and from anywhere else? It is hypocrisy. This was another war about regime change in an oil-rich Arab country. And of course we must hope that the new regime in Libya will be an improvement on the old one, although it is largely led by people who are deeply involved in the old one. I would only draw delegates' attention to the fact that Amnesty International just yesterday said that the new regime has been guilty of major human rights abuses already, particularly in the persecution of black Africans living in Libya. So we must reaffirm the position that was taken by Unite, Unison and other unions earlier on this year, that this war was a mistake, and in particular we must reject the idea once and for all that is so prevalent in Westminster that the British government has the right to choose which regimes around the world are legitimate and which are not, and are intervened to impose regime change. In relation to Afghanistan, I believe the issues are even clearer and starker. This is a war that has now been going on for 10 years, as long as two world wars put together, and it's been going on for at least 9.5 years after its original object, removing the bases of those responsible for the terrible atrocities of 9/11, was accomplished. It is now a war to prop up a discredited pro-Western regime, which is officially the most corrupt regime in the world, which passes legislation banning women from leaving home without a male escort, which has presided over an epic increase in opium production and has no democratic legitimacy or credibility. And this is a war even more dangerous in its regional implications possibly than the war in Iraq. It is now spreading into Pakistan, a nuclear-armed country, destabilising the situation there. It is fraught with disaster and it should be brought to an end now. There is not a single general, diplomat or expert anywhere in the world who now believes this war can be won. Everyone knows it will have to end in a political settlement, a political negotiation involving all parties in Afghanistan. And it is wrong that David Cameron should say he won't even think about withdrawing until 2014. Well, that will mean the loss of life of hundreds of more British soldiers drawn off from economic conscripts from deprived communities in a war that is utterly pointless, utterly unjust, and nothing more will be achieved. This withdrawal from Afghanistan should begin now and without any further delay. And we ought to just have a couple of questions for David Cameron. If this is an age of austerity, how can you find £4 billion a year to attack Afghanistan? How come your big society is big enough to occupy Afghanistan and bomb Libya, but not big enough to keep open care homes and libraries here at home? These are all additional reasons, comrades, why our movement should today once more assert that the cause of Labour is the cause of peace. Thank you very much.
That was Andrew Murray from Unite the Union speaking at the TUC Congress in London last month.
You heard Andrew Murray talking about the plight of the Palestinians. A small minority of Israelis are against the way in which Israel is taking over Palestinian lands. A young activist for the Palestinian cause was recently on a trip to the UK, and these are her views.
My name is Lihi Rothschild. I'm an activist in Boycott From Within and Anarchists Against the Wall, both Israeli group that are in solidarity and in support of the Palestinian struggle.
Can you tell us what's happening over there? You've come straight from Israel, yeah?
Well, I've been in the UK for the past month or so, but I've lived there most of my life.
You're Jewish?
Yeah. By heritage and by familial history, if not by faith, and by the privileges that this grant me according to the State of Israel, which privileges the status of Jewish citizens over all other citizens, and namely Palestinians.
Why are you in support of the Palestinians?
I think that a person can stand still in front of injustice. And there are so many injustices done to the Palestinians by the State of Israel ever since the very first day of its establishment, that I think that it's the duty and obligation of every moral person to come out in support for the Palestinian cause and for the Palestinian rights.
Do a lot of Jewish people feel the same way?
Unfortunately, no. The radical left in Israel is very, very small. There's scarce few activists that are joining in on the Palestinian struggle. there are more activists that are supportive of the rights of the Palestinians in the 67 borders, but they are ignoring the fact that Palestinians inside 48 are being discriminated just the same, and they're ignoring the rights of the refugees. In fact, many of them, of the people who relate themselves to what is called the Zionist left, which is not left whatsoever, are in support of a Jewish ethnocracy just the same, but a Jewish ethnocracy inside the 67 territories, inside the 48 territories, and not from the land to the sea, like some of the right-wing extremist rather see. But as long as you support a Jewish ethnocracy, whether it's on parts of the land or on all of the land, you're against the Palestinians.
Geographically, can you just tell listeners what the 48-67 zones are and about the wall?
Okay, these are two different things. The 48 territories are the territories that are defined by the Green Line that was drawn after the 48 war, interrupted after the UN declaration of the partition program that divided the land of Palestine, was meant to divide the land of Palestine into two states. During this war, 70% of the Palestinian population today, 90% back then, were made into refugees by what became the State of Israel. By the Green Line are defined the 48 territories. The 67 territories are the territories that Israel had taken over during the Six Days War in 1967, which are the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem, and had been occupying ever since, including East Jerusalem that was annexed to Israel. It included several other areas like the Golan Heights that are still occupied, and the Sinai area that was returned to the Egyptians with the peace treaty in 1979. As for the wall, Israel refers to as the separation wall, I rather call it the apartheid wall. That's a wall that actually draws a line in the place that there's no line and separates Palestinians from Palestinians. It is allegedly built in the name of security, while in fact, firstly, it can't prevent anybody from coming in or going out. Secondly, it does not go over the Green Line, over the acknowledged territories of Israel and separating the 48 territories from the 67, but it's going in some weird line that is mostly meant to annex as many territories as possible to Israel, as many of the what Israel refers to as the settlement blocks, and leave as many Palestinians outside of these territories. It goes in between Palestinian villages. Loads and loads of Palestinian lands were confiscated by the State of Israel in order to build this wall. So many trees have been uprooted, so many cultivated lands have been destructed, and so many people were deprived of their farming land, of their homes. There are villages in which the wall actually divides in between houses and in between the village.
What is the object of all this separation?
The main purpose of the State of Israel was always to have as little Palestinian as possible and as many Jews as possible in a certain location. This separation is meant to ensure the control of the Jewish people over the Palestinians. The privileged Jews that are the citizens of Israel and of the State of Israel over the Palestinians.
Why have the Israelis been allowed to treat the Palestinians in this way without the world making any protests?
I don't know. That's something that really bugs me. Any other country that would have been treating people this way would have been sanctioned and criticized by the world. But instead, Israel is just gaining more and more privileges all over the world. It's practically a member of the EU. It's got trade agreements with all countries in the EU, getting support and legitimacy from all Western countries. And it's quite ununderstandable if you put that in the context of the apartheid regime that it has been leading. Furthermore, there are so many situations in which you'd think that if the word Jew would have been placed instead of the word Arab in official documents and non-official documents that are distributed in Israel, the world would have been raging. For that matter, there are buildings in which Arabs, Palestinians can't rent apartments. There are areas in which they can't live. There are so many workplaces that wouldn't employ Palestinians.
That was an Israeli's view of the situation out in the Middle East. And thank you to our reporter, Anthea Page, there. Our next interview is on a bus in Mexico. The passenger, a young man, describes what life is like for young people growing up in a violent society.
I'm travelling on a bus from Cancun in Yucatan Peninsula
down to Playa del Carmen and I've met a young man.
Maldives.
Tell us about your hometown, because it's near the border with the US and there's a lot of drug problems.
Yes, there's a lot of problem in North Mexico right now because cartels are disputing the zones. Where I come from is called the small border because there is a border in between the state of Nuevo León and the state of Tamaulipas. And there are so many drug cartels disputing that zone because there are many drug trafficking through there.
Tell us about the violence, because you've had friends killed there.
Yeah. Well, where I come from, that's Coahuila is bordered with another state named Durango. So one cartel controls one state and one cartel controls the other. And I've seen a lot of shootings in, for example, you are a drug cartel and you own a bar. The other cartels come to your bar and shoot all the people that are in your bar and kill everyone. And you can see it in the internet. You can see the shooting in Bar Las Juanas. You can see shooting at Bar El Ferry. You can see shooting at Quinta Italia. Innocent people killed because they wanted to have some fun and they didn't know that the bar they were attending was controlled by one cartel and the other wanted to shoot them.
So how old are you?
I'm 30 years.
And tell us what life's like for a young person in your town.
Well, I don't consider a young person, but life ends at 9 o'clock. Imagine your city, and I hope your city is okay, but imagine that you are 8:30 or 9 o'clock and everything is closed at 9 o'clock. You can have any nightlife, you can have any bars, you can have any dinner, you can have anything, because by 9 o'clock everything is closed.
Like a curfew?
Yeah.
The cartels, they coerce a lot of young people into them. Why is that?
In Mexico, there is a demographic pyramid. The pyramid, like an inverse movement. Right now in Mexico, the population is mainly young. If you take 10 persons, 6 of them will be very youngsters. They are fresh meat for the cartels. You see the statistics of any shooting, you can see that the Marines or the common soldiers kill, of every 10 persons, they kill 6 youngsters because there are no opportunities, there are no job opportunities, there are no any education opportunities. So they are fresh meat for the cartel. If they get to you, they offer you 10 minimum wages per day to work with them, they are going to be with you. Because there is a culture of, I prefer to live 2 or 3 years as a rich person than live my whole life as a poor person.
What's the government doing about the drug problem, the cartels?
There's always been drug trafficking in Mexico, but I think that the problem in Mexico is that Mexico is not only now a drug trafficking country, it's like a consumer problem. Right now in Mexico, the consumerism is really high because maybe the demand on the U.S. went a little bit stall or went down. So there are a lot of narcotiendas, little stores for drugs in Mexico. So the problem is not only security, it's only a public health problem. So the drug cartels have now a virgin land for the products right now. Governments have always have a pact with drug cartels, but right now there are many drug cartels and many zones are controlled by different drug cartels. So I think the best solution for all is to pact with one cartel and stop the common crime, like the carjack, the assault, those kind of crime, the torture that's really affecting the people from Mexico. Because maybe you have the stereotype of Mexico as a poor country, but Mexico has a lot of wealth. There's a lot of people with their own business, there's a lot of commerce, there's a lot.
Tell us about the oil. They're stealing the oil from the pipelines as well.
It's a really big mafia in the south part of Mexico, in the south border. Part of the drug trafficking, the problem is that the common crime was unleashed. And one of them, it is stealing of oil and petrol from the national company that is Pemex. There's a lot of stealing of oil in Mexico, and it's a really big problem. You can see it in the south part of Mexico, and you can also see it in the north part of Mexico where there are many refineries. There's a lot of oil ducting in the north part of Mexico and the south also.
The violence is affecting the tourist industry. Now, although the violence is contained to some specific areas, it can explode anywhere.
Yeah, sure. There were many parts of Mexico that were silently named as secure, but those parts were also exploding from one time to another. For example, Texas Chamber made a statement that they were asking the youngster not to come to Mexico for the spring break because they couldn't assure any security for them. And I don't blame them because it's really hard right now.
But do tourists get killed very often or not?
Well, you can also be in the tourist zones, but anything can happen because, for example, where I am from, I could tell you that you're safe. Or those persons that were to the bars in my city, they thought they were safe, but they are killed right now.
What happened today in your town? Your father phoned you. He phoned me
in the afternoon. He told me that two or three blocks from my house, there were grenades thrown to a police office that was right from my home. It's really hard. I don't think this is going to have some end in the short lap.
Do the cartels target the police?
Yeah, sure. Well, it's a cartel is taking power of its own. They take power of the police. They take power of the local government. And I've seen it. You could see when this problem was not too high, you could see trucks with people with guns in the street and they were passing by with patrols and there was no problem. Because take power of a specific zone and they are not touched. That's why there is so many problems with the cities that have border with other cities that are controlled with other cartel.
There's a lot of roadblocks and police. What are they there for with guns?
I don't think they are useful. Because police know where are these guys. They know where they live. They know their names. They know what are their actions. These kind of roadblocks are just like a showtime event. They are just taking advantage of other people and taking money out of them.
Is it safe to travel on the buses here?
I think it's better. But I can assure that, for example, one of my employees, his wife, went to the north border to buy some stuff in one truck. Well, she went to the office and told me that they were stopped by a convoy of three trucks and they took all the money of them and took all their merchandise. But it's really difficult. I can assure you, you're going to be safe in any kind of stuff right now in the north of Mexico.
What about here in Yucatan?
Well, Yucatan is one of the safest places statistically. Well, the statistics, because here in Yucatan is the place with the least executions in Mexico. But I can assure you can be safe. You have to know where you move on. But maybe tomorrow the violence explodes here and violence gets from my region to here. I don't know.
Finally, let's talk about the chief of security in your town. They tried to kill him.
In one of my estate? Well, they tried to kill the chief of security of the policeman chief. But in my estate, there have been mayors killed.
The mayor killed?
Yeah, there have been mayors killed in my state. Not in my city, but there in my state, there have been mayors killed.
Why did they kill the mayor? Because they won't conform to the cartels?
Well, that's part of the problem. They arrange some settlement with one cartel and the other one comes there and they kill him because they have already arranged some. Or, for example, in this state, Gregory Sanchez, the person that was running for governor in this state.
What, in Yucatan?
No, in Quintana Roo. Gregory Sanchez, he was busted by the police because he had known business with the mafia.
What's going to happen to Mexico?
Well, I don't think the demand of drugs in the U.S. is going to be fulfilled someday. So I think maybe Mexico has to arrange a pact with a definite cartel and eradicate the others because the common crime is unleashed right now.
Thank you to our reporter Anthony Page, who was talking to a passenger on a bus in the Yucatan province of Mexico.
Time now for part 5, chapter 22 of Treasure Island, written by Robert Louis Stevenson and read by Malcolm Grieve.
Thank you. Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Part 5, My Sea Adventure. Chapter 22, How I Began My Sea Adventure. There was no return of the mutineers, not so much as another shot out of the woods. They had got their rations for that day, as the captain put it, and we had the place to ourselves in a quiet time to overhaul the wounded and get dinner. Squire and I cooked outside in spite of the danger, and even outside we could hardly tell what we were at, for horror of the loud groans that reached us from the doctor's patients. Out of the 8 men who had fallen in the action, only 3 still breathed. That one of the pirates who had been shot at the loophole, Hunter, and Captain Smollett. And of these, the first 2 were as good as dead. The mutineer, indeed, died under the doctor's knife. And Hunter, do what we could, never recovered consciousness in this world. He lingered all day, breathing loudly like the old buccaneer at home in his apoplectic fit. But the bones of his chest had been crushed by the blow and his skull fractured in falling. And sometime in the following night, without sign or sound, he went to his maker. As for the captain, his wounds were grievous indeed, but not dangerous. No organ was fatally injured. Anderson's ball, for it was Job that shot him first, had broken his shoulder blade and touched the lung, but not badly. The second had only torn and displaced some muscles in the calf. He was sure to recover, the doctor said, but in the meantime, and for weeks to come, he must not walk nor move his arm, nor so much as speak, when he could help it. My own accidental cut across the knuckles was a flea bite. Dr. Livesey patched it up with plaster and pulled my ears for me into the bargain. After dinner, the squire and the doctor sat by the captain's side a while in consultation, and when they had talked to their heart's content, it being then a little past noon, the doctor took up his hat and pistols, girt on a cutlass, put a chart in his pocket, and with a musket over his shoulder crossed the palisade on the north side and set off briskly through the trees. Grey and I were sitting together at the far end of the blockhouse to be out of earshot of our officers consulting, and Grey took his pipe out of his mouth and fairly forgot to put it back in again, so thunderstruck was he at this occurrence. "Why, in the name of Davy Jones," said he, "is Dr. Livesey mad?" "Why, no," says I. "He's about the last of this crew for that, I take it." "Well, shipmate," said Grey, "mad he may not be, but if he's not, you mark my words, I am." "I take it," replied I, "the doctor has his idea, and if I am right, he's going now to see Ben Gunn." I was right, as it appeared later, but in the meantime, the house being stiflingly hot, and the little patch of sand inside the palisade ablaze with midday sun, I began to get another thought into my head, which was not by any means so right. What I began to do was to envy the doctor, walking in the cool shadow of the woods with the birds about him and the pleasant smell of the pines, while I sat grilling with my clothes stuck to the hot resin, and so much blood around me, and so many poor dead bodies lying all around, that I took a disgust of the place that was almost as strong as fear. All the time I was washing out the blockhouse, and then washing up the things from dinner, this disgust and envy kept growing stronger and stronger, till at last, being near a bread bag and no one then observing me, I took the first step towards my escapade, and filled both pockets of my coat with biscuit. I was a fool, if you like, and certainly I was going to do a foolish, over-bold act, but I was determined to do it with all the precautions in my power. These biscuits, should anything befall me, would keep me at least from starving till far on in the next day. The next thing I laid hold of was a brace of pistols, and as I already had a powder horn and bullets, I felt myself well supplied with arms. As for the scheme in my head, it was not a bad one in itself. I was to go down the sandy spit that divides the anchorage on the east from the open sea, find the white rock I had observed last evening, and ascertain whether it was there or not that Ben Gunn had hidden his boat. A thing quite worth doing, as I still believe. But as I was certain I should not be allowed to leave the enclosure, my only plan was to take French leave. and slip out when nobody was watching. And that was so bad a way of doing it as to make the thing itself wrong. But I was only a boy, and I had made my mind up. Well, as things at last fell out, I found an admirable opportunity. The squire and Grey were busy helping the captain with his bandages. The coast was clear. I made a bolt for it over the stockade and into the thickest of the trees, and before my absence was observed, I was out of cry of my companions. This was my second folly, far worse than the first, as I left but two sound men to guard the house. But, like the first, it was a help towards saving all of us. I took my way straight for the east coast of the island, for I was determined to go down the seaside of the spit to avoid all chance of observation from the anchorage. It was already late in the afternoon, although still warm and sunny. As I continued to thread the tall woods, I could hear from far before me not only the continuous thunder of the surf, but a certain tossing of foliage and grinding of boughs, which showed me the sea breeze had set in higher than usual. Soon, cool draughts of air began to reach me, and a few steps farther, I came forth into the open borders of the grove, and saw the sea lying blue and sunny to the horizon, and the surf tumbling and tossing its foam along the beach. I have never seen the sea quiet around Treasure Island. The sun might blaze overhead, the air be without a breath, the surface smooth and blue, but still these great rollers would be running along all the external coast, thundering and thundering by day and night. And I scarce believe there is one spot in the island where a man would be out of earshot of their noise. I walked along beside the surf with great enjoyment, till thinking I was now got far enough to the south, I took the cover of some thick bushes and crept warily up to the ridge of the spit. Behind me was the sea, in front the anchorage. The sea breeze, as though it had the sooner blown itself out by its unusual violence, was already at an end. It had been succeeded by light, variable airs from the south and southeast, carrying great banks of fog, and the anchorage under the lee of Skeleton Island lay still and leaden as when we first entered it. The Hispaniola, in that unbroken mirror, was exactly portrayed from the truck to the waterline, the Jolly Roger, hanging from her peak. Alongside lay one of the gigs, silver in the starn sheets. Him I could always recognise, while a couple of men were leaning over the starn bulwarks, one of them with a red cap, the very rogue that I had seen some hours before stride legs upon the palisade. Apparently they were talking and laughing, though at that distance, upwards of a mile, I could of course hear no word of what was said. All at once there began the most horrid, unearthly screaming, which at first startled me badly, although I had soon remembered the voice of Captain Flint, and even thought I could make out the bird by her bright plumage, as she sat perched upon her master's wrist. Soon after, the jolly boat shoved off and pulled for shore, and the man with the red cap and his comrade went below by the cabin companion. Just about the same time, the sun had gone down behind the spyglass, and as the fog was collecting rapidly, it began to grow dark in earnest. I saw that I must lose no time if I were to find the boat that evening. The white rock, visible enough above the brush, was still some eighth of a mile further down the spit, and it took me a goodish while to get up with it, crawling, often on all fours, amongst the scrub. Night had almost come when I laid my hand on its rough sides. Right below it, there was an exceeding small hollow of green turf, hidden by banks and a thick underwood about knee-deep, that grew there very plentifully, and in the centre of that dell, sure enough, a little tent of goatskins, like what the gypsies carry about with them in England. I dropped into the hollow, lifted the side of the tent, and there was Ben Gunn's boat. Homemade, if ever anything was homemade. A rude, lopsided framework of tough wood, and stretched upon that a covering of goatskin with the hair inside. The thing was extremely small, even for me, and I can hardly imagine that it could have floated with a full-sized man. There was one thwart, set as low as possible, a kind of stretcher in the bows, and a double paddle for propulsion. I had not seen a coracle such as the ancient Britons made, but I have seen one since, and I can give you no fairer idea of Ben Gunn's boat than by saying it was like the first and the worst coracle ever made by man. But the great advantage of the coracle it certainly possessed, for it was exceedingly light and portable. Well, now that I had found the boat, you would have thought I had had enough of truantry for once. But in the meantime, I had taken another notion and become so obstinately fond of it that I would have carried it out, I believe, in the teeth of Captain Smollett himself. This was to slip out under cover of the night, cut the Hispaniola adrift and let her go ashore where she fancied. I had quite made up my mind that the mutineers, after their repulse of the morning, had nothing nearer their hearts than to up anchor and away to sea. This, I thought, it would be a fine thing to prevent. And now that I had seen how they left their watchmen unprovided with a boat, I thought it might be done with little risk. Down I sat to wait for darkness, and made a hearty meal of biscuit. It was a night out of 10,000 for my purpose. The fog had now buried all heaven. As the last rays of daylight dwindled and disappeared, absolute blackness settled down on Treasure Island, and when at last I shouldered the coracle and groped my way stumblingly out of the hollow where I had supped, there were but two points visible on the whole anchorage. One was the great fire on shore by which the defeated pirates lay carousing in the swamp. The other, a mere blur of light upon the darkness, indicated the position of the anchored ship. She had swung round to the ebb. Her bow was now towards me. The only lights on board were in the cabin, and what I saw was merely a reflection on the fog of the strong rays that flowed from the stern window. The ebb had already run some time, and I had to wade through a long belt of swampy sand where I sank several times above the ankle before I came to the edge of the retreating water, and wading a little in, with some strength and dexterity, set my coracle keel downwards on the surface.
That was part 5, chapter 22 of Treasure Island, written by Robert Louis Stevenson and read by Malcolm Grieve. Mark Sayers is here in the studio to read his poetry.
I travel to Weston-super-Mare once a month for a poetry evening, and this is one of my journeys. By bus to Weston-super-Mare.
Please give up these seats if
they plead. How dare the little squirt sit there? Elderly or the disabled need them. It's no good. He doesn't care. He knows how many beans make five. With legs outstretched, my knees are trapped. A teacher's pet who'll never skive. Without a doubt, he should be zapped. He's 12 and fit, and yet can't see that old folk fought a war for him. In fact, without them, he'd not be here. His crime's grim. He looks so prim. The smartest blazer ever seen. Yes, sir, he's got it all worked out. If old Flo sat there, bet she'd scream when he pulled his sharp penknife out and impaled her where it hurt most. She really wouldn't stand a chance. No doubt when back at school he'd boast of how he made her leap and dance. In the third row sits patient Flo. That's her seat. and she's 85, with not many more years to go. He'll haunt her now, dead or alive. Should that nice driver stop his bus? The young these days make me despair. Yet I don't want to make a fuss, or we'll be late at Supermare. Why don't I take him on the sands? If the tide's out, all will be well. For sinking mud, he'll understand. His screams the knell which augurs hell. I'll push him down as the mud gropes. He'll choke, his two eyes out on stalks, which should teach him old ladies' hope for those front seats to sit and talk. So here's his stop, the little swine. He picks his crutches off the floor. To think those wicked thoughts were mine. John hobbles home to his front door.
Finally, Jeff Sparks is here with the What Song Guide.
Hello, this is your What Song Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 14th of October, the finest tribute to madness, Nuttiness, will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews, Bristol. Tickets are £5 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. On Saturday, 15th of October, On the Edge will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews, Bristol. Tickets are £5 in advance and £7 on the door and doors open at 7:30 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Jason and the Scorchers. This group formed in 1981 and to date have released 13 albums. This is from the live album Midnight Roads and Stages Scene, which was released in 1998, and is a song titled Last Time Around.
Last time around.
That was Jason and the Scorchers with Last Time Around from the live album Midnight Roads and Stages Scene, which was released in 1998. Into Sunday, 16th of October, the Overtones will be performing at the Colston Hall, which is in Colston Street, Bristol. Tickets cost £19.50 in advance and £23.50 on the door, and doors open at 7 p.m. Finally, on 16th of October, Steve Payne will be performing at the Carnation Tap in Sion Place, Bristol. Entry is £3 on the door, and the gig starts at 4 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
That's all from Dialect this week. Features were by Tony Gosling and Anthea Page. Malcolm Grieve read Part 5, Chapter 22 of Treasure Island by Robert Louis Stevenson. Poetry was by Mark Sayers. And the What's On Guide was by Jeff Sparks.
The presenters were myself, John Peters Coleman.
And myself, Sophia Costa.
And the engineer was Michael Lois, and the producer was Anthea Page. So until next week, goodbye.
Goodbye.
While nations wash their bloodied hands of Lord.